Before we begin, just giving you an update on our new subscription. It's called David McWilliams Plus on Apple. You just double click, you get no ads, and you get me and John, pure and simple.
And Mac, you get early access episodes. Did you know that?
Sure, my day is made.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time. We are going to talk property, but not the property that's probably been on your mind if you're listening in Ireland, which has been the nexus between politicians and grubby backhanders and having their own little private portfolio while they are making decisions about the property market. Not that. We're going to go to a much, much bigger and potentially profoundly much more destabilizing property bubble, which is the one that has just burst in China. I don't think it's getting enough attention internationally. I think we forget that China is the second largest economy in the world. Property is sucking in a huge amount of Chinese resources. They are just, again, for Irish audiences, we've seen this movie. We know how it ends. We know what happens when the banks, the politicians, the developers are all involved, scaring the bejesus out of the punters. We know what happens when a property market implodes. It doesn't end well. It's not pretty. You get a balance sheet recession. It can actually drag the economy for many, many years, right?
And it's the fellas at the bottom that suffer most.
Well, it's always, it's a pyramid scheme. So we're going to talk about China in 2 seconds, John, because what is going on in China is phenomenal. What else is annoying you this week?
Well, no, just on, to stay on the China property thing, what I saw recently was on Twitter or YouTube, I can't remember which, but there was lots of videos of China blowing up these massive apartment blocks and blowing up 10 at a time. So in other words, just wiping out half a city in one fell swoop.
Well, you know what that shows you, John, right, is that John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher and economist from the Victorian age, said something very interesting about booms. He said the bust, this was after the railway collapse in 1850s, is not what destroys your wealth. The bust merely evidences the stupidity of decisions taken in the boom. And that's exactly what you're seeing with those estates being blown up, those apartment blocks, right?
Yeah.
It just reveals the profound waste of money. Now, if it is more financially viable to blow up those developments than continue to finish them, it shows you the hole and the waste of money that's been going on in China. So let's, folks in the Chinese property market, let us go over to one of the best analysts of China. He's one of the economists, number of analysts working in China. His name is Mike Bird. He's all over the story. Let's go to China. There are bubbles everywhere. There are bubbles in markets. There are bubbles in bond markets. There are bubbles in all sorts of assets. Wherever you look over the last 10, 15 years of easy money, right? But one that is particularly geostrategically important is the bubble and subsequent what looks like meltdown in the Chinese property market. I want to go now straight to China to talk to Mike Bird, who is the Economist's man, or one of the Economist magazine's man in Asia and in China. Mike, how are you?
Hey, David. I'm very well. It's actually Singapore now. I've moved from Hong Kong. It's just slightly earlier in the year.
Well, you know, speaking of Singapore, I won't digress, but I will slightly. I just watched the movie. John is giggling already. It's called Crazy Rich Asians. I watched it the other day on Netflix. Oh my God. If that's what Singapore is like, I want to go to the wedding.
That's why Mike moved there, I'd say.
That's it. Nice bit of trivia, actually, is the sort of properties they film Crazy Rich Asians in are so ludicrously expensive and actually quite rare in Singapore that they had to film almost all of that stuff in Malaysia, where it was easier to actually get inside the mansions.
That is hilarious. I want to come back to Singapore, actually, because Singapore's got a very interesting property model for the average guy, but let's go straight to China. It really, really does. I mean, Singapore is one of those amazing stories that has managed to keep a lid on property prices for the average dude. Not at the very high end, but for the average dude. We may well come back to that because I think it offers a model, certainly for Ireland, certainly for the UK, you know, large European cities where things are going out of control. But let's go to China. Tell me what is happening on the ground in the Chinese property market.
So I think the bottom line, the easiest way to explain this is Chinese residential investment, housing sales, house building, that part of the economy is absolutely enormous. It's an area of the economy that has been growing faster than China's relatively high GDP growth for almost all of the last 20 years. You've only seen very, very narrow periods where that hasn't been the case. And I'll come back to those periods in a little bit. The bottom line of what's happening now is housing sales are down 32% year on year. This is sort of completely uncharted territory for the Chinese economy. This sort of thing simply does not happen. People are used to pretty rapid growth in housing sales, which means pretty rapid growth in credit to the household sector and housing prices as well. So it's pretty grim times at the moment.
So let's just go right back, okay? When I say right back, in the case of Chinese property, we're talking about going back 20, 25 years, private property was more or less outlawed up until the 90s. What happened to the Chinese investor, the average Chinese person, the Chinese psyche that saw the Chinese putting so much into property once they were allowed to own property?
I think that's exactly it. So the Chinese property liberalization basically starts in the late 1980s. There's this very strange set of circumstances where you jump in the space of a few years from private property, as you say, being basically completely illegal to Chinese private property not only being encouraged as an asset class for households to own, but also being at the sort of root of the way that Chinese local governments raise all of their money. So you had a series of fiscal reforms in the mid-1990s that massively encouraged Chinese local governments to sell land. And really, they're selling land use rights. Technically, the state still owns all of the land in China. But this has made it basically extremely lucrative and useful for local governments. And it's also given them this massive incentive, funnily enough, to let land prices rise as much as they possibly can. Because low land prices are of benefit to basically nobody in China as part of this calculus. So 1994, you get this major fiscal change, the change in the tax system, not a stimulus. You had this major change. By the late 1990s, you have the development of the Chinese property industry. Really, as we know it now, the major developers are in full swing. Everything's getting going. Massive residential investment. You basically have a problem in China. If that's the push side of things, the incentive on the part of the local governments to sell as much land, the pull side of things is a country with an incredibly high savings rate. It's got a ludicrously high savings rate and incredibly low consumption and very, very few other decent financial products to put money in. Basically, in China, for a very large portion of this time, you had three or four choices. You had fairly unreliable stock market. Chinese stocks for buy and hold investors have been pretty terrible, unreliable, volatile, a lot of dodgy companies, a lot of companies that are simply not very profitable. You have bank deposits where the returns are pretty low. You have had all sorts of strange trust products where there have been a number of blow-ups. They'll often offer huge guaranteed returns. They've been terrible. Or you've got housing. Housing has been the guaranteed, worthwhile, reliable, high return investment. Chinese households know that very well. They're very well aware, in fact, of the sort of political constraints around housing and that really housing prices can't be allowed to drop that much. So you've had these two push and pull factors that have made this into such a sort of ridiculously frenetic housing market.
It's really interesting, Mike. As I listen to you, you're talking the language that I heard in Ireland in 2005. Number one was we have a young population. We have a very, very outdated housing stock. The state is getting VAT from the sale of every single house. So precisely as you say, local government, ours was central government, had a huge incentive to keep this going because it was a tax-generating gig.
Yeah.
You have a whole entire echelon of quasi-professional and professional pushers of the product because everyone's making a few quid. And suddenly you get this inferno of speculation, investment, et cetera, whatever you want to call it. Now in China, let's go fast forward, you have mortgage boycotts, mortgage strikes. What is happening?
So
I want to go from there to what we are now, then we analyze it, then we look forward.
Absolutely. So the mortgage boycotts now are essentially, well, as it says on the tin, it's people refusing to pay their mortgages. But it's a little bit different to the way it works in other countries. And to understand this, you have to go a little bit into how real estate developers finance themselves in China. So for quite a long time, the Chinese government has been trying to prevent the real estate sector becoming too big a share of bank lending. That's the real estate developers in particular. So the real estate developers began turning, I think, especially after the financial crisis, to international bond markets. So they issue a huge amount of dollar debt. This has been a big funding market for them. Now, more recently than that, the past couple of years, the Chinese government has introduced a policy called the Three Red Lines policy. So this has actually been quite a strict restriction on real estate developer funding.
If I can just stop you there, just for Irish listeners, just that idea of real estate developers issuing bonds, right? For the Irish case, just so you know, that is Irish banks issuing short-term instruments to get more cash in the door to lend to Irish developers. Just so you know the similarities. So in Ireland, the developers weren't going directly to the bond market. The banks were going to the bond market on behalf of the developers. Okay, so let's go. It's the same sort of thing. Keep going.
So basically, the bottom line is there is a third method of funding, which Chinese real estate developers, other than banks and bond markets, have used very, very heavily. Indeed, it's been a growing source of their funding, even as the companies themselves have boomed over the last sort of decade or so, and that is pre-sales of housing.
Oh yeah, this is interesting.
The developers will open a local center, it'll be a shop front, and they'll have their little models of what a development's going to look like, and people will come in, and they'll be given a price list, and you want a two-bedroom flat, three-bedroom flat, whatever it is, it's going to be on this ring road in this city, put your money down. The deposits in China are very large. You're talking about often 30, 50% of the cost of the property. You get your mortgage out, you start paying your mortgage to the property company and they put down a date sometime in the future, 18 months, 2 years, 2.5 years, whatever it is, that says, come and get your house now. There's probably a minor discount in it for you having agreed to the pre-sale. Now, in a lot of the rest of the world, that would go in some sort of escrow account. It would go into some sort of form of legal protection so that the developer can't run away with the money. Now, in most of China, these accounts simply don't exist. These have been used, so a real estate developer will get the pre-sales from a development that they've just advertised, and they will use that money to pay for the development that they promised to the guy 18 months ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, right? So this is where you get into the sort of... you get into the Ponzi financing, essentially, which is where this is. It requires the growth. If you don't have the next layer of pre-sales, then you simply can't build what you've already promised to build. This is the difficulty. So as these developers have hit the real financial hard straits in the last 6-12 months, these properties aren't being built anymore. You have people paying mortgages on properties that are not only being delayed, but there is no longer any evidence they will ever get. The developers are in such dire straits that a lot of the developments have just ceased, which is why people have stopped paying their mortgages.
Now, again, the reason I'm knitting back and forth again, it's mainly for Irish, European, British, American audiences, because we've seen this before, except in the European case, in the British case, in the Irish case, in the American case, you put down your deposit. Your deposit is usually reasonably modest, right? It's reasonably modest in terms of the price of the house, but believe me, if you're a young Irish buyer, it's a huge chunk of any potential income you ever had. Interestingly, developers here use exactly the same game, except what they do is they put it in an escrow account, but they use that escrow account for collateral to banks who genuflect the escrow account and extend credit. So it's, again, what we're talking about. I want to Americanize or in some way put it into the European, American, British world. This shit happens here too, okay? Except it's a little bit more sophisticated, less blatant. So what we're saying is that what we have on the demand and supply side of finance, we have the demand eating the supply eating the demand. And once you start getting falls off in sales, then the entire supply chain of credit, it's the sort of contagion. We're looking at a contagion at the center of the Chinese property market.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, for me, the question then is where are the consequences? How does this end, basically? Yeah. And that's where I think it gets particularly interesting. My colleagues, Don Wineland and Simon Cox, who write about the Chinese economy and Chinese business and finance, they've written about this extensively, and I talked to them. They're both of the same mind, and so are actually most of the people that I speak to. What's really interesting here is if you compare this to what happened in 2015-16, which is where some people will remember you had a little bit of a sort of pre-runner of this. You had a wobble in the housing market, and that led to a wobble in the value of the Chinese yuan. You had a little sort of dip there. You had people wondering whether this was going to start a chain of devaluation, whether it's going to cause capital outflows. Now, that avenue seems to be basically closed this time. The risk of this causing massive capital outflows seems lower in the sense that the capital controls seem to work pretty well, as they have for several years. The banks actually look relatively stable. And that might sound unusual, but remember that these are state-run banks. And as long as there are no capital outflows, to a large extent, the Chinese government can keep these things under control. We've seen over the past sort of 6 or 7 years a pretty high level of ability from the Chinese government in sort of putting out financial fires as and when they erupt. So the question then becomes, if you can put these fires out, where do the consequences end up spilling over? They have to end up somewhere. You can't keep this sort of system propped up without consequences. My view, personally, is that these end up displaying themselves in long-term Chinese productivity, that you have these colossal overinvestments in an asset that is essentially deeply unproductive. You know, if you look at the rental yields on Chinese residential property, this stuff looks like pre-financial crisis Ireland on steroids, right? A lot of these places just don't have rental markets. There are no income returns to owning these properties. They just sit vacant with people just expecting speculative gains. So this is like, you know, you can tell the level of speculative activity just from how little income the owners are able to make from these properties.
So that's the reasonably benign outlook, is that you've a largely closed economy, you've a largely sealed off current account, you've a pool of savings that the government can basically deposit from one area to the other, right? Unlike a European country, Ireland, Britain, or the United States during the 2008 crisis where money flows out, okay? So the benign thing is the Chinese figure this out. What is the less benign risk case?
I mean, so I'll say two things. One is anyone who pretends they have an accurate, decent, complete map of the Chinese financial system is not telling you the truth. That I suspect there is no regulator or politician or analyst who has a full view of everything going on here. The small bank crises that you've seen in the past few years often emerge fairly quickly, and people don't have full visibility on this stuff. The other thing is that this is a confidence-based system. The reason that people are willing to pay for flats, for houses that are worth oftentimes 30, 35 times the income level of the city that they live in is because they have the confidence that the prices continue to go up. When you remove that confidence, as we know from many other examples, that's when things can start to go south. The final thing I'd say on the sort of productivity side is that might actually not be the benign way of these things playing out. That could trap, to my view, Chinese economic growth for a very long time. It's a very, very big economy, but we got to remember that in terms of the personal income levels, the per capita size of the economy, it is really not a particularly prosperous economy yet. If you have this sort of persistent productivity shortfall, this constant misallocation of capital into really, really wasteful areas like real estate, where you're not making any return from it, you're going to see China sort of enter this middle income trap territory a lot earlier than it might have otherwise done.
Just a quick question, Mike. What size of GDP is real estate in China?
So the residential investment, so the annual amount going in, is about 10% of GDP. So to put that in a bit of context, it was about $1.7 trillion worth last year. That's relative to $1.1 trillion in the US in the same year, which is 4% of US GDP.
Yeah, the US is about twice as big.
Yeah, it's more than twice the size. And you got to remember that last year was a crazy year in the US housing market as well. So essentially, China is having a sort of investment level that's 2.5 times, say, the US level in a frenetic year every year for a decade or more.
And the interesting thing is what you're saying is that there's a productivity drag. There's also a wealth drag, right? And this is the other side, is that people get pissed off, right? So if Mao's promises, we'll make you all equal, Deng's promises, we'll make you all rich, and Xi's promises, I'll make you continue to be rich. I mean, we have the Taiwan saber rattling. We have the coronation of Xi coming up in a couple of months' time. To what extent is Taiwan, all the saber rattling, again, a device to try and obscure the fact that what we have deep in the Chinese family around the kitchen table are conversations about housing?
I think it's a good point. And I think that one thing that's really important to remember about housing is, as you say, it is so close to the core of the sort of social compact. It's so crucial that this is a reliable source of wealth, in large part because there is not another reliable source of wealth. We're not just talking about housing wealth as you might perceive it in Europe or in the US. China's got a very parsimonious welfare state. You know, this is how you make sure that your children are looked after. This is how you make sure that your grandparents don't suffer in their old age. It is so, so important, and sort of threats to the value that you have essentially been promised are really, you know, they're important social and political issues as well.
And then just finally, what do you think it tells us about the great judgment of Xi and the fellas around him? Because one of the great myths, you know, I've been to China about 5 times, I haven't been for about 5 years, but constantly the conversations we'd have was sort of like, well, there's this all-knowing, all-powerful, omnipotent, wise men at the top who figured out everything. You know, every time I talk to Chinese people, and these were very, very clever Chinese people, they were analysts, they were economists, that clearly doesn't make them clever, obviously, but they were, you know, they had a good handle. And their default position was kind of, the Politburo knows what it's doing.
Yeah.
What does it say about their judgment if they're presiding over a property collapse, a banking crisis, and the need to bail out a massive part of the Chinese economy?
I mean, I think it speaks very much to the core of the lie. To my view, it's a lie that you often hear, which is that if you have a one-party state or an autocratic government, they're able to think in decades. You know, they don't make the same sort of long-term strategic mistakes that democratic regimes do, because, you know, they're able to look ahead and you know, they see the whole chessboard and all of that nonsense. This is something that no shortage of people in the Chinese government frankly saw coming down the road years ago. They've just not worked out a way to stop the train without it coming off the tracks, basically. There's too much wealth tied up with it. There's too many promises tied up with it. And now it's coming off the tracks. And I think that the Chinese government seems to presume that there's a sort of plan here, that they know what they're doing. But really, the absolute levels of money and perceived wealth that are threatened here, I would say, you know, it's a huge, huge issue.
Mike, we leave it there. Now, by the way, Mike presents the Money Talks podcast of The Economist. Really, really well worth having a listen to. It's the last one, I think the last one but one, was on this issue of China. But it's a fantastic podcast. And again, with The Economist, they've got, unlike John and I, they have slightly more resources, I suspect. Slightly
more resources.
Well, listen, Mike, that was great. And I hope that Sheffield United, to your beloved team, I think the story you told off air of your father allowing you gob in the general direction of Sheffield Wednesday is pretty impressive.
I can't now send my dad the link to this podcast. He will get very annoyed that I've shared this story.
No. Tell him that it shows depth, profundity, loyalty, dislike, hatred, all the great things that go into a proper football fan.
Yeah, this is Mike. Great
to talk to you. Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Cheers, David. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So there's a couple of things there that Mike was talking about that I want to expand on a little bit. And one of them is the system in the way that the developers worked and the banks worked in China was quite obviously, and you used the phrase yourself, was a Ponzi scheme.
Is a Ponzi scheme.
Is a Ponzi scheme, which is really bizarre. But also you asked the question there, which I want to pick up on. You asked the question of Mike of, what does it actually say about Xi Jinping and the Politburo and their judgment on running shit? You know, they should have seen this coming.
Well, you remember...
And how come they lost control, them being control freaks and all the rest?
Do you know the American film producer, MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer?
Yes.
I think one of the guys, I think it was Goldwyn, when he was asked... the key to his success, he goes, nobody knows nothing about nothing, right? And what he was basically saying, we're all kind of bullshitting. We're all going through the motions. We're all hoping to God it all works. The world is far too complicated to understand everything. And I think what it shows is that the Politburo in China are just human. They're just humans trying to make decisions under conditions of profound, profound uncertainty. And an interesting thing about economics, John, is that classical economics rests on the assumption, this is the interesting thing, that humans are all powerful, all knowing, brilliant, living in a very uncomplicated world. That's the basis of classical economics, where in actual fact, the opposite is the case. Humans are really kind of stupid and we don't know anything. And we're living in an unbelievably complicated world. Right. So in order to understand the world properly, you've got to reverse economics on its head and realize that, you know, when they say man is rational, utility, maximizing, scientific, la, la, la. Right. That's not how we are at all. And we are unbelievably dumb, living in an unbelievably complicated world. Economics assumes that we are unbelievably clever, living in an incredibly unsophisticated world, an easy world. And I think, in fairness to the Politburo, and I'm sure they'll be very glad to hear this from the Dave McWilliams podcast, right? In fairness to the Politburo, they're just humans.
I'm sure they're listening.
They're listening away. But they're just humans making decisions, hoping for the best. The law of unintended consequences, John, is probably one of the greatest observations about everything. That the world is so complicated. You do one thing, you hope for one thing, something else happens. What I think is more worrying for them, John, is that property collapses destroy economic confidence. And property collapses destroy faith in the financial system. And property collapses destroy trust in the political infrastructure. And that's why I believe the Chinese should be more worried, because everything's based on faith. Because the world is so complicated, faith and trust are unbelievably important because we actually trust things that we don't know anything about. You take away the trust and you destroy everything. While I have you there, listen, I just want to say thank you so much to all our Patreons who really supported myself and John throughout the last nearly 3 years, man.
3 years, wow.
Oh, it's a long time. I thought it only started last week. It's such a good crack, though, isn't it?
It is.
It's like having the dream gig, you know. Thank you very, very much. And if you do want to support us on Patreon, it's patreon.com/David McWilliams. You get ad-free, you get courses, you get chats, you can ask me questions, all sorts of stuff, and you really become part of the gang. So that's patreon.com/David McWilliams. And again, thank you very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.